KCPW's broadcast from the Daily Buzz of the 2016 Sundance Film Festival is brought to you in part by Cotopaxi, Gear for Good, and from Naja Pham Lockwood and David Lockwood.
This is day 9 of the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org in Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. Guests on the show include a VR panel with Magnus Kim from Chaotic Good and Mario Kenyon from Furious M. We'll talk about the film Slight with J.D. Dillard, the director and co-writer of the film, as well as his co-writer and producer Alex Thurr, and we'll have replays of interviews with the filmmakers behind the films The Lure, Hooligan Sparrows, and The Settlers. All that and more right after the news. And you're listening to the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. We are here in Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Kim Boyner, and we are going to be talking VR once again, because we've been focusing on that quite a bit for
it's
a very good
favorite
reason.
Favorite topic.
I'm learning a lot this week. And with us on this segment, we have Mario Kenyon from Furious M and Magnus Kim from Chaotic Good. And Kim, let's start off with this and lead into our conversation.
Right. So we've had a lot of content creators talking about their VR exhibits here, including people from Defrost, who I know you're affiliated with peripherally, Mario. I wonder if we could start off with you telling us a little bit about what Furious M is aiming to do. I know from talking to you throughout the fest that you guys are working in distribution in the VR space, but you can explain maybe a little more about what you're up to.
So my company's called Furious M, and we're an early round startup. And essentially what we're trying to do is build and map out the VR audience. VR is obviously a little bit different than other types of content because you need a headset to view the stuff. And not everyone really knows who has a headset. And further, not many people are even aware that VR is accessible to the masses right now. And so what we're trying to do is capture metadata, analyze kind of trends from where people are getting their VR and who would be interested in it. And so the projects that we work on are specifically aimed at storytelling, but also they're not single experiences. We believe that serialized VR might be the way to bring this to the mainstream, and so people really get attached to the content, to what they're feeling. So it's really been great working with Defrost because it is story-based and it's really connecting with people. And I think a lot of people who experience Defrost are realizing that VR is such an impactful platform to tell a story. And it's a new way of experiencing a story. And that's kind of what we're trying to get the word out about.
Maria, one of the things when we were talking the other night with your team, one of the things that struck me is that when we're talking with filmmakers about VR content, especially early VR content, 360 documentary or 360 narrative like what you guys have done, you're kind of looking at the door opening for distribution. It's a completely different distribution channel where potentially content creators can get their content directly to consumers,
right,
and bypass some of the traditional channels, even bypassing Amazon, which of course has been a big buzz around the fest. But there might be a path through what you're doing to find doorways for people to get their content directly self-distributed.
Yeah, so we're focusing on mobile VR, and we believe that with this new technology and with things like cardboard and gear, we can go directly to the consumer. We can find out who's interested in this content, and we can have them subscribe and then allow them to find a way to get a headset, get a cardboard, or get a gear if they have a Samsung.
You guys, you even have, a mechanism where they can order a VR, cardboard to view the content if they don't already have one, right?
Right, yeah. So we'll have links on our site, working with company called NextWorks, and they've created a content capsule for us. And we'll have links to actually buy the cardboard on the site. So it's very simple. People don't have to go searching for the right one. It's a quality cardboard. And we're really hoping that, you know, somebody is going to create a headset like the Gear for the iPhone, because everybody's been raving about the gear and kind of Apple, what are you guys doing? You know, you're kind of missing the boat here. But hopefully someone will get on that.
And Magnus, let's pop over to you now. Your company is called Chaotic Good. And could you maybe explain for our listeners at home a little bit about what you do and then what your interest is in the VR space specifically?
Sure. So it's not the easiest thing to explain. So basically what we do is we design and develop franchises for clients. So we work with companies like Activision Blizzard and Warner Brothers and Coca-Cola. And, you know, everyone's got IPs of varying forms, whether it be a book, a movie, a toy, or a product. We tend to step back and look at it and see what world that exists in and create that world around it if it doesn't exist. And then from that world that we build out, we look for more IP opportunities to exploit. And going off of that, we see VR as the next big frontier. It's you know, I think everyone talks about it as a nascent industry. And it probably is, because I think the technology is obviously still market-driven right now, and it's kind of hard to figure out who's going to be dominant. I kind of believe with, you know, agree with Mario that you know, the more accessible it is in terms of like using your smartphone and things like that, and using things like cardboard, which are very low to no cost solutions, that's like a great way to go. But there's also other markets for that too, that you want high-end experiences. You want, you know, obviously theater owners and distribution companies have different ideas about that because they want to control the experience and they want to charge a premium on it as well.
Right.
And so there's different degrees of that. And I think it's interesting for me. The takeaway for me at Sundance is no matter what medium you look at, whether it's television, film, or anything like that, it all comes back to the content. And from where I sit right now for what we do, we're kind of technology agnostic. We're going to sit back and let the market decide what it is. I think for us, we're going to see that it really comes down to who can connect with the audience at a really truly emotional level.
Without the content, all the hardware is just a doorstop or a paperweight, right?
Exactly.
If you don't have something compelling to share.
If you can engage the audience and pull them through, and you know, if you're the first person that makes them cry, laugh, you know, be
empathy
be afraid,
in VR
yeah.
is like the catchphrase of not only of Sundance, but of the VR dev community in general over the last 9 months or so. We used to talk, you know, a year and a half or so ago, transmedia was the big buzzword.
Sure. Now it's a no-no word.
Then transmedia kind of started to fade into transvergence, convergence. We're not, you know, there's always the new buzzword. How much are you looking to play in that, maybe that cross-platform, cross-disciplinary space? Do you see VR as an extension, a way to extend an IP world as opposed to an end in and of itself?
Definitely extension. And I think for a lot of different mediums that we design for our clients, VR will have a place in it because it enhances the experience. It gives a different set of tool sets to engage that audience and make them feel more connected, more emotional.
It seems to me that the VR audience is a limited audience in terms of financial capacity. So are there options for people who don't have the ability to purchase the hardware or the software necessary?
Absolutely. I think Mario touched on it early with the cardboard and Gear VR are the two most often talked about. Even non-cardboard, but cardboard kind of compatible rigs.
Right.
You can go on Amazon and spend $30-$40 and buy like a plastic goggle thing that you put your smartphone in.
But even with that, you have to have a lot of the other accessories.
Sure.
Right? And you have to be able to have access to go online to be able to experience it once you have the actual hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that this is actually limiting the audience?
That's an interesting question.
Because it doesn't really have an easy distribution.
I like to jump in on this.
Yeah,
would say it's not that it's limiting. It's that we're still in the very early stages of VR adoption. And from a technological standpoint, we're very much in the early adopter phase. We're in the phase where it's the people who are already investing in that technology who have the gear. When we look at the trajectory of technology and the price points going down over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see it drop 5 to 15% a year to a consumer price point level. And at the same time, you're going to see more and more companies doing outreach into libraries and schools, the places where we're going to see an equalization of that content into diverse areas.
I agree. I think it's like, you know, when flat panel TVs came out, they were $10,000.
Right.
And now you can buy one for $200. And so I think it's just a market-driven thing. There are costs involved with R&D, and obviously there's a gold rush right now in terms of VC community and these technologies and formats that, you know, kind of scary for me, for how I look at it, but someone's going to come out to the top. And like I said earlier, it just goes back to content. Once that's figured out, no matter what it is, it's got to have good content.
Is that audience primarily millennials?
Gosh, you want to take that, Mario?
Right.
No pressure, Mario.
Magnus hands the mic over.
As I pull back my gray hairs.
What we've noticed has been really, really interesting, actually. Obviously, early adopters are millennials, and they're the ones who are going out and using cardboard and buying the gear. But what we've noticed with DeFrost in particular is the older generation is going nuts over this. So my grandma, Randall Kleiser, who's director of DeFrost, his mom, and then all of these older people, when they see this experience, they are so connected. And we've actually had a few instances where people talk back to the characters.
You have a video of somebody's grandmother experiencing it and interacting, and she's like, oh, thank you. Yes, you look nice too.
Yeah.
You look very, and I was like, that is just perfect. That's like marketing 101.
So at DeFrost, you actually become the character. You wake up after being frozen for 30 years, and doctor tells you can't talk, you can't really move, you're in this wheelchair, and so you really feel like you're the character, and that's where this empathy and presence comes in. And people who really let themselves feel like this character, they talk back and they cry, and this is all happening in 4 to 6 minutes. It's about 5 minutes and 37 seconds, and so that shows you, demonstrates how powerful this tool really is to connect with people on such a deep emotional level in that amount of time. So I think that even in the beginning, it might be millennials, but I think everybody is going to see this once they have an experience that resonates with them, mm-hmm. how impactful and powerful VR is.
And I think you're going to see more companies like your clients, Magnus, are going to be looking to have that empathetic presence within the kind of content that you're looking to help them with, too.
Absolutely.
Again, we've been talking about VR, virtual reality, and with our guests, Mario Kenyon from Furious M and Magnus Kim from Chaotic Good. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back to the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. And my name is John Wildman, here with my producer of the show and co-host, Irene Cho. And right now we're talking about a film that I've been looking forward to chatting about, because I've been talking it up to everybody since I saw it. The movie's title is Slight. It's from the Next section at Sundance. We have with us the director and co-writer, J.D. Dillard, and co-writer-producer, Alex Thurer. Welcome, guys.
Hi, thank you.
All right. For the people who haven't had a chance to see Slight yet, JD, let's have you put it in your words. Give your sales pitch right now. What is the film about?
It is about a young street magician who, with that very peculiar skill set, tries to avoid from getting sucked too much deeper into the crime world that he's in. But he's wound up there just by circumstance, just to take care of his family. You know, his heart is not in that, you know, line of work. And it's just about that balance between passion and, you know, what you kind of just, how would you say it?
It's, you know, there's what you want to do with your life, and there's what you sort of have to do to make ends meet and stuff like that. So, you know, following your passion and following, you know, it's basically street magic, and being sucked into something else that's much more dangerous for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And then watching him use these skills to help hopefully get out of this situation.
Here's what impressed me about this movie. It is wonderfully entertaining, and there is a great balance there between kind of the genres that you touch on, because there are thriller elements, you know, there's a romance element, there's even a little bit of a fantastical element.
That's why we can't describe it very well.
Yeah,
it's like all over the place.
Exactly. But here's the thing, you know, as a first-time feature director, JD, you know, we see, especially in the Next category, we see films all the time. We go, "Oh, this is, you know, this is a personal vision. This is a heartfelt movie. This is the movie that had to be made." But we don't always see what seems to be that you seem to have a keen insight into actually entertaining an audience. And I would love for you to talk for a moment whether or not you just luck into that, and we just happen to have an entertaining film from the movie that you and Alex wrote here, or if that is in your mind, if you actually think as a filmmaker, audience in mind, because directors don't always do that.
Well, I mean, Alex and I come from the genre world. Slight is sort of an anomaly for us, just because it is much smaller, and I mean, well, smaller is probably the biggest thing. We tend to write just big, nonsensical, whatever. But in 2015, we really wanted to shoot our own movie. Having gone through the development process with, you know, more studio-oriented places, it's just the process takes a very long time, and you're sort of doing it theoretically. You're not sure if, you know, you'll ever see actors say these words. So with Slight, we decided in scaling, you know, a genre movie down, we also wanted to just pull from all the things that we do love about movies. And it's not just science fiction, but it is to, you know, be character first and tell a drama, and to have, you know, a little bit of a romance thing, and to, you know, have still elements of genre that we care about and thriller, and just really to make it a mixed genre piece, because at the time, I mean, that's how our minds are working. It's just we want to watch all of these movies. And I think if you look at our list of, I guess, like reference movies, they're not related at all. I mean, we talk about Sicario, we talk about Blue Ruin, we talk about Star Wars. Like, none of these movies have anything to do with each other.
That is a random group of films.
No, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your background. I understand that you made music videos.
Yeah, and music, that was, we both have sort of worked in that world. I wouldn't say that's sort of the real impetus of our career. It's really been screenwriting forward.
Talk a little bit about how you guys met and how you collaborate together.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah.
We met bowling.
We met bowling. So many filmmakers
exactly.
have
Exactly. No, we've been working together for, I think it's a little over 5 years now. And it, you know, it really just came from a place of just finding something that, you know, we're fans of everything. And even talking about sort of the fact that, you know, Slight's a little bit more commercial, it does really come from a place of, like, you know, we've seen everything, and we're trying to write something that we would love, that we would really appreciate, and that, you know, and just kind of finding new territories in existing genres, that sort of stuff.
And then on top of that, we're definitely, like, you know, an audience's filmmaker. Like, we are obsessed with movies being fun, and we want what we're doing to be fun. Even though Slight sits a little bit more on the drama side than I think maybe ages ago we had thought it would be, it's still following the characters and finding those elements within that story to make it fun and to make it pop.
And just talking about writing and just our background a little bit, it is always about character first, that sort of stuff. So the first thing that we did, which never got off the ground, it was like a deconstruction of a superhero movie.
Sounds great.
Yeah, but pre-Marvel, and just now, I think now that movie would just never sort of...
oversaturated.
Yeah, exactly. Right. All those sort of things. But it is, it's finding things that we love, and it's harder than ever to find a sort of a new story in this environment. But it is really about those things. And sometimes it's, you know, a big bombastic, something that is kind of like $100 million sort of thing that we could never get off the ground. And sometimes it's a really small sort of personal story. And this was the first time, and it was so liberating to write, to shoot, and to have that in mind the whole time while we were writing. It was fantastic.
Did you kind of reverse engineer it a little bit as far as what you could afford? Especially because, again, you've got some fantastical elements in here, you know, effects-wise, that you have to manage. So, you know, so did you have that in mind as you guys were working on the script?
I think on the macro, we definitely did. Just, you know, knowing that, okay, we probably can't have a, you know, 10-car police chase. And we just know that, like, as we're putting the major pieces together, we have to keep that in mind. But with just broad parameter set, I think we just, for that first draft, we let ourselves just freely write it. And then after getting, like, a first pass of the budget, it's like, cool, so we'll need to, like, tighten up here, and we'll need to tighten up here, and maybe expand a little bit over there. But for the very first pass, I think we were pretty freely writing.
And it was also, we, you know, it's contemporary LA, so a lot of the other things we do, like, we build whole sort of new worlds, and kind of there's just a lot of big foundations in there, so... dealing with a story where it's not so rule-oriented and sort of just all these things.
Yeah.
We knew we were coming from an okay place. JD has a big background in magic. We knew a lot of sort of what we wanted to do, and even just doing, like, old-school traditional kind of camera work to get some of these effects across. That was super fun.
So can I ask, who were the magicians that influenced you the most?
I mean, it's really just all types of street magic. I mean, David Blaine was who made me want to get into magic, and I'd seen sort of stagey magic before, but just that very intimate, close-up, impromptu feeling magic is, I think, the most powerful. Because people have a guard up when, you know, there is, like, a lot of showmanship involved, and I think even though David Blaine obviously has a persona, the really incredible thing about what he does is that it's happening right here, right now, and even the way that he delivers it, it seems bigger than life because he's just a guy. He's just a guy on the street.
What's the difference between traditional magic and street magic? Are magicians competitive that way?
I don't know if it's a really competitive separation, but I think that, so street magic is basically impromptu. It's stuff that you can carry on yourself. It's
something that would happen right now versus you going to a show. So the magic sort of comes to you a little bit.
And there are things like, you know, like rings and, you know, the rope tricks, like that's all typically more theatrical, and street magic is impromptu. So it's just keeping to things that, yeah, you could really just do with your hands.
I'd also love to hear you guys talk about something that we have a lot of filmmakers that are here in Park City that you know, their films are, you know, working probably on an even smaller budget than what you guys had. And, you know, and they're putting out first films, and you're always, you know, under that pressure of having name talent. Mm-hmm. In your film, you guys have Dulé Hill, who does an amazing performance. And I'd love to hear you talk about, one, how you got him. And you know, because, again, this is your first feature. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are an unknown quantity. You know, and my assumption is, you know, he came on because he doesn't get asked to play that kind of role, which he plays this incredibly charismatic, you know, a drug dealer, you know, violent and sinister. But can you talk about, you know, just nuts and bolts as filmmakers, how you got him and what that meant?
Well, you know, I think the great thing about having Dulé in that role is we were looking for any way to subvert small things within the genre, and it'd be very easy to have the, you know, the sort of like urban crime boss guy just be covered in tattoos and be wearing bling, and like you've seen that. And the beautiful thing about Dulé's performance and just his sensibility and what he brings to that character is when you meet him, you can really see why and how Beau would be seduced by, you know, how nice he is and how fun he is and all of that.
And then just to say, we have excellent casting directors. That was a big part of it. So, you know, we really did. And they, we got good reads. We just got very, very good, good reads and brought people in. Dulé was obviously the biggest get. JD sat down with him and just sort of talked about what that role would be in subverting it the way he was saying. But then also, immediately, Dulé also had so much more insight. It's like, Angelo's a character, he's right the whole movie. He's not coming from some nefarious place. He's actually just in the right.
Yeah, and looking to subvert a genre element, like, you know, you don't want the mustache twirly villain whose plan you're sort of having a hard time swallowing, and that happens with a lot of genre movies. But Dulé technically is, if you jump in his POV, he's never making a wrong decision. People
around
So he's making all the right choices.
Well, obviously, you two made a lot of right decisions in making this movie as well. Again, the film is Slight, from in the next category, a wonderfully entertaining film and a great debut by you guys. Again, J.D. Dillard, the director, co-writer, Alex Thurr, co-writer, producer. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And we're back on the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org here in Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival. My name is John Wildman here with Irene Cho, producer of the show and my co-host. And we're going to talk about a film that's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition here at Sundance. The title of the film is Hooligan Sparrow, and we have Nanfu Wong, the director, writer on the film. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Okay. The film follows Hooligan Sparrow, Yehaya, and the protests and activism that she has been for quite a while leading in China, and a group of other activists with her, and your experiences both following her and filming her, but actually kind of becoming embroiled in all of this stuff that was going on there, and frankly, putting yourself in the line of fire as well from the Chinese government. Let's start off this way. Why did you feel you needed to go back and you needed to do a documentary on her and her work?
Well, I came to the United States in 2011 to start a documentary. And before that, I'd never touched a camera, or I didn't know anything about filmmaking, but I always wanted to make films because I felt like films allowed me, when I was in China, allowed me to see the world and to visit places and get into people's lives without being physically there or living that life. So I thought I want to go outside the world and make films and use the images to translate what I see so people back home, they can see things that they can't. And the other way is I want to show the China I saw to people here so they can experience. And the story about Ye Haiyan, Hooligan Sparrow, because I've been following her on social media for quite a few years. She has 70,000 followers on Twitter. And I knew that she was bold, confrontational, used her body nudity a lot, like women's rights activism. And that's when I decided I want to go back and film her and find out what kind of person she was.
Right. You know, on the international scene, I think that the big thing that really kind of exploded as far as her notoriety was offering to have sex for free to bring awareness for sex workers there in China. Now, here's what I really love about this documentary. We oftentimes see what I call important documentaries, films that are calling our attention to something that we need to pay attention to, that maybe we need to do something about. What we don't often see is those films being made well, the craft being made well. And I believe this is your debut, correct?
Yeah.
All right, so it is made well. And I would love to have you talk about balancing what had to be a very emotional process for you, because again, you were facing the threat of the Chinese government and people that were trying to shut you down. You know, yet you also have to tell a story. You have to translate that story to people that have no idea about it. Can you talk about that balance as a filmmaker?
Yeah, it was a huge challenge for me because in China, because we were constantly on the run, fleeing from one city to another, and the entire film, outdoor scenes, all shot handheld. I couldn't bring a tripod because it's very obvious, and we were followed by secret police all the time. And even the smallest DSLR is too big, so I had to come up with ways of using different devices like point and shoot, then it's big too, and the micro camera, hidden cameras, spy glasses, all kinds of things. And getting the footage out was like another challenge. And I remember going to the shipping service and they would tell me that we cannot do this or we would be followed by secret police, and you know that they are monitoring the footage. So at the end, we had to smuggle the footage out. And so those are two very big challenges. And I remember being very scared as I was threatened by the secret police. They were like, you dare to film and now we will kill you. You want to live here alive or not? But at the time, it was like the anger that I have, that things like this are happening in China, but nobody knows. I didn't know, even though I lived in China for 25 years. And my family and friends didn't know until the National Security Agents called them. So I felt like if nobody can record this, people wouldn't know. So that was like the number one goal, no matter what. I wanted to document as much as I could.
So you make it out of there. You get your footage out of there. Mm-hmm. Now you have to edit this. And, you know, and again, you know, a documentary filmmaker has to then come up with a story. You know, when we say you're the writer, this is not fiction, but you're writing, you're crafting the storyline, how you're presenting this. And can you talk about those challenges? Because it's challenge enough just for you to get that footage. But now this is another huge challenge.
Yeah, for example, I secretly recorded the interrogation the National Security Agents did on me. They interrogated me for 5 hours. But what I did is I put an audio recorder underneath like my dress in the underpants. So the whole 5 hours interrogation, I only had audio and there was no visual. So when I was, and there are things like this in the film, quite like a few places. And there was a challenge, like, would the audience be bored? You know, there is no visual, it's just going to be audio. And for the interrogation, I only use the audio and this text. And then there are a couple of places it like forced me to think creatively what you can use as visual and to visualize the audio. And it's interesting because at our premiere, a person next said, I really appreciate that there is no visual, or you use some metaphorical visual for something that only had audio, and it worked well.
Something you did, I thought was just a wonderful stylistic choice, and it was, you know, it's saying, well, of course you had to do it that way, but you didn't have to do it this way. There's a point in the film where, you know, you're taking footage of these men that are looking at you, and some are taking pictures or what have you, and, you know, and so everybody we see, we're thinking, this is a threat. This guy is out to shut her down, to do, you know, to hurt her, to do worse. And then later we find out that, you know, one of those guys, we find out actually what his identity is. And then you take us back to that footage, and it's like you go, remember this guy? Remember that guy that we saw? We thought he was this, but he's actually this other thing.
Yeah, it's funny because editing is a discovery process for me, because when I was on the location, there was so much going on, and you were constantly watched by people, and you don't know who is who. You don't realize one is a secret police officer until that you see him at another location following you. So when I was editing, even today, I still like, oh my God, this guy, he was at that scene, but I totally didn't notice him. And he's been following us around, and I only saw him while I was editing the film. Yeah.
That's so great. I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Ye Haiyan. Mm-hmm. How did you connect with her? I mean, obviously you followed her on Twitter, but how did you develop that bond? It seems that you were very close, almost like family members.
Oh, yeah.
And she was so open and so vulnerable in the film, and she must have developed that trust with you. So can you talk about that process?
It was actually a very funny story, because I called her when I was in New York, and she said, come back and we'll talk. So I returned to China, and I said, hey, I'm back in China, can we meet? And she said, I'm not at home. And I said, when will you go back? And she said, I don't know, maybe a month, maybe two, maybe three, I don't know. And I was like, I come back to make a movie, and I cannot meet you. So I managed to ask her, would you please at least tell me which city you are at? And she said, I'm in Guangzhou City. And like in a split second, I said, oh, wow, such a coincidence. I'm in Guangzhou City too, which I wasn't. I was like 400 miles away. And I said, can we meet tomorrow since I'm here? And then we managed to schedule an appointment. And she never showed up. We scheduled to meet at 7 o'clock at one place. I called her for 2 hours, and she didn't answer the phone. And this happened over and over for 3 days. And to the point that I almost wanted to give up. I thought, this person is weird. Like, she is not responsive. She didn't apologize. And
sure.
And then when I finally met her, like 3 days later, and in person, she apologized. She's like, I'm so sorry. I'm in the middle of something that is very secretive, and I didn't want to talk about it on the phone. And she said, I'm in the conference. If you want, you can wait for me at the conference. And she opened the door, and that's like a dozen, probably the most high-profile activists in China, most wanted by the government. And they were discussing how to plan this protest and how to avoid the risk.
So for our listeners that aren't as familiar mm-hmm. with the very big campaign that Ye Haiyan did, please explain the sign that she posted, the photos that she posted, and the reason why she was offering up this service for free.
Okay, so the protest that she was planning is against a principal and a government official who raped 6 young girls aged between 11 and 14. But at the time, the government was trying to cover it up. So she led a group of activists and went to the school, and she held up a sign saying, hey, principal, why don't you get a room with me and leave the kids alone? And because the previous campaigns that she did, like offering free sex to migrant workers, so a lot of people find that sign really amusing. And over the next few days, thousands of people in China, they posted them a picture of themselves like holding the same sign. And that really made the government mad. And that's why Sparrow was arrested the next day.
Can you also talk about when you do a film like this, you can't just put it away. You kind of have to live with this film. And as you were making it, you know, was there a point where you came to that realization and accepted it? When did that point happen where you go, no, this is much more than just a subject that, you know, people are going to watch and then I'm off to the next thing?
Yeah, I think 2 weeks after I was filming, my family got the first phone call from National Security Agents, and my family, they lived probably 600 miles away from where I was shooting at the time. And that's when I realized it was serious. But then about a month later, my friends who I went to college with, they were in Shanghai, which is like totally non-related to anywhere where I was or Sparrow was or my family was. And they were taken into interrogation one day just from work. And that's when I was thinking, this is a national, the scale is huge. And yeah.
Well, it's again, it's a remarkable film. It's a subject that needs the light shone on it quite brightly, and I think you've done it very well. Again, the title of the film is Hooligan Sparrow in the World Cinema Documentary Competition at Sundance, and we've been joined by Nan Fu Wong, the director of the film. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We are on KCPW and kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and I'm here with our producer and co-host, Irene Cho. And we're going to talk to a filmmaker about a film that it's like my favorite thing so far. The film is The Lure. Our director, and I'm going to try to say the name correctly, Agnieszka Smoltynska.
Smoltynska.
So close. This film, I've been describing it as likely the only magical realism musical horror film about mermaids that you will see this year, if ever.
Thank you.
I almost don't know where to start, but we'll start with this. What came first, the mermaids or the music for you?
You know, the first came the protagonist, because the first moment I wanted to tell the story about two young girls who grows up in a dance club, because me as a small girl, my mom used to run two restaurants when they were musicians play music alive. And my friends, they are musicians, and we wanted to make this film together. And they also grew up in such a restaurant because their parents were musicians, and we started to work on a story about two girls who grew up in such a place, but one of them said, oh no, it's too close to us, it's too personal, I don't want to tell the story which tells about young girl, you know, the first cigarettes, the first, you know, the first sex and everything, it's too close. And that's why we decided to...
You went to mermaids.
Yeah, that's why we decided to make a film about mermaid, because mermaid is a metaphor of young girl. And it's like a mask. We can hide behind this. That's why we have mermaids.
All right, well, to catch our audience up very quickly. All right, so we have a family that's kind of like a little musical group.
Yeah.
And they are on a beachfront, and our two mermaids, gold and silver, come up and literally, and this is not a spoiler because this happens in the first scene. They literally say, you know, let us come on land with you, and we promise not to eat you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you
exactly.
go, well, okay, if you promise you're not going to eat me, sure. All right, come on. And the film, I think, it does this wonderful job of balancing this giddy musical world that you create with that dread and that creeping dread of, well, they said they're not going to eat us, but you know, they kind of want to eat us.
Yeah, exactly. Because our mermaids are, you know, the mermaids like from Homer, not from Disney, the first, you know, the Ariel, and they devour people. And that's why we decided to make musical, but also a horror film and also a comedy, because our mermaids are hybrid. That's why we have a hybrid film.
Tell us about you, your background. How did you decide to become a filmmaker?
You know, when I was a young girl and I really grew up in such a restaurant, my mom, of course, she wanted me to be a manager of kind of restaurant, but I really liked to watch performing. I really liked to be singer when I was 5 years, 6 years. After that, I want to be actress. But after when I grew, I want, oh no, when I was 14, I decided I want to be director, the film director. So I'm here. It's my first feature film.
Congratulations. What an achievement for your first feature.
Yeah, it's true. And it's really, when we get to know that we come here to Sundance Film Festival, for everybody from my group, from my team, it was really shocked. And nobody believes us. And it was, you know, because our mermaids, in a story, they came to Poland. And after Poland, they want to, you know, just have fun. And after that, they want to go to America, to US, because there is, you know, the musicals. That's why they want to come here.
Well, seriously, what flesh-eating mermaid doesn't want to come to America? I mean, seriously. Well, you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of the film is because you come to Sundance and you hope to see something unexpected. You hope to see something that is going to catch you completely awares. And again, as I've said it, to many people, the lore, it strikes me as crazy in all the right ways. I'm also very curious as to what films influenced you.
What films, you know, to be honest, there was one film, because as you said, this is really very original film, very original genre, and there are some films. Of course, I like Tim Burton film, Sweeney Todd. Of course, I know, you know, there is the title for this particular movie. I think there were clips of Bjork sometimes. There were, to be honest, there were paintings of Aleksandra Waliszewska. It wasn't only films, but also paintings, photographs. I mean, the Diane Arbus, Nan Goldin, and also Sally Mann. So my inspiration was not only films, but the really arts, the visual arts, and also, of course, music. And music for me, very important, was music of these composers, the music band Ballade Romance. They are inspired in many, many, many music bands, also in Poland, but also from US, and you know, it's like this.
I'm also on the practical filmmaking level, talking about visual, is that you have mermaids, and so they have tails.
Yeah.
And can you talk about the challenges of, you know, of directing your actresses and your actresses having, because you're right, they're not Disney mermaids. I mean, you know, these tails are like long, huge, like, you know, snaky, kind of eel-like, you know.
Yes, it's not sexy fish tail. When we, you know, that's our film is. It's we were really thinking about what kind of fish tail we should have, because, you know, it's mermaids is like a monster, a half beautiful girl and a half a monster, and we want to tell the story, a failed story for adults. And I really was searching for such a kind of fish tail, and because of Aleksandra Waliszewska, she is a painter, this fish tail is huge. It's almost 2 meters long, and it's filled with slim and mucus, something is very
slime.
Wet
slime
yes. That's what I have to learn by heart. Slime. And we had trainings with my actresses, because we built this this fish tail for 3 months from silicone, because we had practical models. And it lasts 3 months. And after that, they had to really go inside this model. But they had only 2 weeks or 1 day to be inside and behave like a mermaid. We have to really search, you know, the movement of her, how she feels. And
Did you try the tail too?
Of course. Of course.
Tail around. You got to try it.
You know, in a newspaper in Poland, I asked them, because they wanted to me, you know, have, okay, but only in fishtail. And of course. And the singer, in the one character, she also wanted to have this kind of fishtail. Yeah. Every girl wants to have a fishtail, I think.
And I think after people see the film, that many other people want to have those fish tails. Again, we've been talking to Agnieszka Smoltanska.
I got it right that time. From the film The Lure. Again, congratulations on the film, and thank you for coming by.
Yeah, thank you very much for talking.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We are on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kim Boyner, and our producer, Irene Cho. And right now we're going to talk to the filmmaker, Shimon Dutan, from the film The Settlers. And Shimon, for people who are listening have not had a chance, obviously, to see the film as of yet. If you can give us a quick idea, because this is a subject you've dealt with before in your films, in a general sense, but this film in particular, what is The Settlers? What are you looking at?
We hear a lot about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. In the world imagination, it seems to be the obstacle to any peaceful arrangement in the region, which it is. Yet I find that very little is known about the phenomenon itself, and it's poorly understood, not only by the world at large, but by many Israelis as well. When I did Hot House, a previous film that was screened here at Sundance, I was traveling in the West Bank, and I came upon a roadblock that was initiated by the Israeli military, and they brought huge cement blocks to block the road to prevent settlers from crossing into Palestinian territory. And I saw settlers from a nearby settlement called Shiloh running and throwing themselves under these huge cement blocks to prevent the Israeli military from blocking their access with vehicles to the Palestinian territories. That was quite alarming to me. You saw these young men and women actually putting their life on the line for something that was quite obscure at the time. And for me as an Israeli, that was a kind of revelation. There is a new kind of extremism or fanaticism that is so prevalent in the West Bank today. And I thought that's something to be explored further. On top of that, the settlements are actually changing the tone that Israel is, the way that Israel is presenting itself vis-a-vis the world. And this is quite alarming, and I find it a real threat to Israel in many ways. So,
it's very interesting how in Hot House you addressed the fanaticism on the Palestinian side about how the Israeli prisons have become a breeding ground for terrorism, and now in this you're addressing fanaticism from the other side. I'm wondering if you see it as a push-pull on both sides that needs to be addressed. Is that what drove you to make a film more specifically about the settlers and the Israeli side of the fanaticism?
Well, I do believe that the evolution in the region, in any place of conflict, is actually driven by the extremists. Those in the center or the majority almost have no voice in such a conflict. And for us to understand or to try to find some kind of a solution, we have to explore, to study the extremists. And as you said, rightly so, I did it with the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. And in a way, it's the counterpart of those individuals in the Israeli settlements.
How did the settlers take your perspective when you approached them about making the film? Did they see you as being on their side? Did you approach it that you were going to be kind of neutral?
No, quite the opposite. And I was making it very clear with every encounter that I had with settlers that I am in opposition to their point of view, that I think that the settlements are a threat, a real threat to the very existence of the state of Israel. Not to its physical existence, but to its moral fabric and many other elements that will really damage the country in an irreparable way, I would say. But I made it a point to present my views because I didn't want to steal anything from them. I didn't want them to catch them, so to speak. And remarkably, they find it just the beginning of a discussion. And in a way, that crystallized their idea even more in order to either convince me or to present a counter argument that gives, I think, a very thorough understanding of where they are coming from.
There's a woman in the film, Sarah, who features quite prominently throughout the film. Could you talk a little about how you got drawn to making her such a central part of your storytelling?
You refer to Sarah Nachshon with the baby?
The one with the baby.
Yeah. I often ask myself questions about the nexus between the individual and the national, the plural. Where does it cross? Where an individual attempt or action evolves or transforms into something that carries either a mythical or a bigger presence in a society. And what happened with this Sarah Nachshon is quite remarkable. She was from the very first settlers that got into Hebron, which is the biggest Palestinian city in the West Bank. And she seems, on the face of it, not a very sophisticated individual, but she has a deep belief and very strong convictions. Her son, her second son, that was born in Hebron and was circumcised against all rules in the cave of the patriarchs, died of SIDS at the age of 5 months. She decided she wants to bury him in the old cemetery in Hebron, which was deep into the Palestinian side of the city of Hebron. She drove with her baby towards the cemetery, and the military put blockade to prevent her from doing so. She took the dead baby out of the car and she started walking with the dead baby towards the cemetery. The soldiers could not physically stop her, could not bring themselves to physically stop her. And it became an issue as she was walking. It was quite a walk. And the issue came up all the way to the Ministry of Defense, and they've decided just to let her do it in a whimsical decision, not really thinking about the consequences of it.
But it did have a long-term impact.
Exactly. So what happened? The burial took place in the old cemetery of Hebron. Because there was a fresh grave there, the military had to position a platoon to protect the grave from being desecrated. Once the military platoon was there, the settlers that were out of Hebron at that time felt more secure and started to move more freely into Hebron. And that was the beginning of the Jewish enclave inside the city of Hebron, which is one of the most contentious a spot in the whole West Bank, and we leave it until this very day.
And it started from this mother with an emotional situation,
exactly.
Probably not even driven by the politics, right? She was, or do you think that she was? Was she more politically driven?
I don't think that was so remarkable about it. And therefore, I said earlier that I'm always intrigued by this point of transition where an individual will evolves or becomes something that become national, become mythical. And I find it that very often it's the starting point is very personal, without any agenda to carry it to a further. I no doubt in my mind that she did not ever at the time was thinking that would be the
she
beginning.
She wasn't thinking, I'm going to carry my dead baby to be a political
exactly.
symbol, but it became
exactly.
that.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Listen, thank you, Shimon Dutan from The Settlers, for joining us, and congratulations on bringing your second film to the Sundance Film Festival.
Thank you very much.
Wrapping up day 9 of the Daily Buzz on KCPW. The show is made possible with the support of our sponsors, Cloud Electronics, Nadja and David Lockwood, and SoundCloud, with support from Skullcandy, Cotopaxi, Pop Art Snacks, Angry Porcupine, Enki New York, Mountain West Hard Cider, You Offend Me, You Offend My Family, and The Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.
KCPW's broadcast of The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival has been brought to you in part by Cotopaxi Gear for Good and from Nadja Pham Lockwood and David Lockwood.